Hello, this is Unheard Cuts from Speaking of Faith. I'm Trent Gillis, online editor of the program. For the show Days of Awe, Krista interviewed Sharon Brouse, a conservative rabbi in L.A. who was part of a Jewish spiritual renaissance. Listening to the raw interview, we were captivated by her energy. She speaks fast, though, and we wanted to keep that sense of spontaneity while allowing the listener to ponder some of her more profound thoughts about the High Holy Days. We'd like you to have that same access and hear what we did in the studio. This conversation took place on August 14, 2007, via an ISDN line, with Krista in studio at Minnesota Public Radio and Sharon Brouse at NPR West in L.A.
We do get to have a real conversation because it's not live, and we get to edit it later. And so it doesn't have to be linear. You know, we'll just see where it goes, and I hope we'll be surprised.
Okay.
But my thought is you have to imagine, you know, our listeners, there will be devout Jewish listeners out there, but there'll also be plenty of people who come from many other traditions or, you know, are Jewish but not practicing. And I think what I'd like to do is just start by really having you kind of talk me through and walk me through the Days of Awe rituals and some of the ideas and the readings. You know, not obviously the whole thing, but just high points and what's important to you. And, I mean, I have some specific questions and some ideas about where we want to start and where we want to go. And out of that, we'll just start also having a conversation about what it means and what it means to modern people. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, that's great.
Okay. And, you know, I'm interested in big ideas and high theology and also, and I think you do this as a rabbi, so this is not going to be a stretch for you, just always linking that back to human experience and real life. And I want to encourage you to speak for yourself as well as a rabbi. But I think you know that. Okay. So. Okay.
Thank you for saying it.
All right.
Okay. I'll try. I'm a little nervous.
All right. Well,
we'll see. Might take a few minutes.
Okay. Well, it usually does. It often does. Often the first few minutes we end up are just kind of getting acquainted. Yeah.
Okay.
So, all right. So let's start. And I think I thought maybe, I know just from reading some of what you've written that you did not grow up in an especially observant home and that you came to this as a young adult. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I wondered if you might talk to me just about your memories of these high holy days, maybe growing up a bit, but then also how you began to experience them when you came back to taking Jewish tradition seriously, when, as you say, you fell in love with it, and kind of just, you know, and I'll just this is another aside. I mean, we're really going to get at big ideas and big themes in Judaism, but kind of focused through the lens of the High Holy Days, which is a perfectly good place for them to be focused. So does that make sense? Sort of, what are your memories of really understanding what this is about?
So, but I think actually the most, I know that you said you saw the map that I made.
Yeah, and actually I have that in front of me too.
Okay, so I actually think the most important part of the map is the introduction, that just the first page, because I talk a little bit about my experience with High Holy Days growing up and how completely irrelevant the whole experience was to our existence as human beings and, you know, as individuals and as a family, as a community. The liturgy was completely uninspiring for me. Mm-hmm. It was the kind of community, I think, very reflective of kind of mainstream American Jewry, not non-Orthodox Jewry, but it was very pristine and distant. And the cantor and the cantor did all of the praying and the rabbi did all of the speaking and the congregants were spectators in their own religious experience. And that was all that we knew growing up. And so we found ways to busy ourselves during services. we counted heads, we counted light bulbs, we counted how long the shofar blasts would last. We found things to do to occupy ourselves because it was treacherously long and completely uninspiring, for us. And so, you know, some, I'm not sure how much to say of what I've written here or not.
Yeah. But put it into your own words. Don't read it. Just tell me.
I mean, I just... I'm just trying to think of how to say this without insulting the rabbi I grew up with too terribly. But I mean, it seemed as though the religious life not only had nothing to do with what was going on in the world, but had nothing to do with what was going on in our own lives. And so we would sort of take a perfunctory break from our lives and come into this space that out of only obligation, not religious obligation, but really familial obligation, because that's what Jews were supposed to do and Jews in my family did. And we would just sit for hours and hours in desperate boredom, kind of waiting for the service to end so that we could have a break fast or go home and, live our lives again. And it wasn't for many, many years until I realized that really that it didn't have to be that way, that there was more to this incredibly powerful tradition. The rabbis say that the Torah was handed down in fire, and in fire it is to be transmitted from one generation to the next. Mm. And growing up, we had no sense that there was anything, that there was any real power or spiritual sustenance to be derived from our religious life. And, you know, then in the religious establishment, in the Jewish establishment, everyone would kind of throw their hands in the air and say, why are we losing all the young people to Buddhism? Or why are they all going to India to study? And the reality is, I mean, sitting through torturous services for hours and hours and hours is just not a compelling religious experience for people anymore. I actually do think that there is something generational going on in the Jewish community now, which is to say that my parents were just as uninspired as we were in services, but they still felt this kind of profound sense of familial obligation to show up. But in my generation, people don't feel swayed by guilt like that anymore. And now people would much rather, you know, take a day at the beach or go read a great novel that will really touch them in a personal way, or develop some meditation practice, or do yoga, or do something else that feels really personally compelling for them. But they're not going to sit through services if they're not touching them deeply in a personal way anymore. And so I do feel that that's part of the generational shift that we're experiencing now.
So tell me, when do you remember first experiencing the High Holy Days and really experiencing them as meaningful and powerful the way you lead them now?
It actually started with Shabbat, then this led to my High Holy Day experience. But I went through a series of really humiliating experiences in my encounter with the Jewish community when I first got to college, primarily because I felt that I really strongly identified as a Jew, but I started becoming aware little by little of the depth of my ignorance of my own tradition, and really became exposed to the judgmentalism and the exclusionary nature of the of many aspects of the Jewish community. And after many of these experiences, I decided that I needed to start to learn, primarily so that I wouldn't be humiliated anymore. I needed to know what my family had rejected, not because I ever wanted to take it on as my own practice, but because I felt that I needed to know how not to fall into the traps of ignorance anymore. Right. And also I needed to know when the people who were kind of criticizing me were wrong, when they were making things up, and what was actually real. And I had no idea. So I started studying, and the person who became my mother-in-law at the time, this is my best friend's mother, later on became my mother-in-law, sent me a list of every single synagogue in New York City where I was in college. And I started going week after week to one service after another, and I hated all of them. They were just miserable experiences, either very traditional and completely alien to me, and nobody greeted me at the door or said hello or said, it looks like you don't know what's going on, can I help you? Or, you know, people were moving and swaying, and I just didn't understand anything that was happening. Or I would go into places where I actually got it, but I felt completely uninspired by what was happening. And I sort of felt like, you know, if I get it, it's actually not real enough because I don't know anything yet. So it has to be a little bit more challenging than that. So one Shabbat, I ended up walking into B'nai Jeshurun in New York City. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of it before, but it was about number 35 on my list of synagogues. Mm-hmm. And I remember turning to David, my best friend at the time, and saying to him, he was on this kind of journey with me, and saying to him, you know, this is it. If this doesn't work, I'm done with the Jewish journey. and I'm just going to focus on, you know, my secular studies. And I sat in the back row of this church. The services were being held in a church at that time. And I just, as soon as the service started and people started singing, I just burst into tears. I felt like I had come home in some absurd way because I had never been there before. I didn't understand a word of what they were saying, but I felt like I got everything that was happening spiritually in that space. And I mean, I was just so stunned by the whole experience. And then the rabbis stopped. We stopped praying, and the rabbis started preaching. And it was, you know, 1991, 1992, and the rabbis started talking about AIDS. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. That I was here. I was in this kind of sacred space, and hearing religious leaders talk about something so relevant and so also. So dangerous to talk about, because at that time, religious leaders weren't speaking publicly about it. And they were talking about how homophobia and how fear of how fear is driving people away from understanding the depths of the dimension of this great tragedy, this pandemic that's, you know, that is occurring, and that we had an obligation as Jews and as human beings to join in the fight against against AIDS. Mm. I couldn't believe what I was hearing, and I was so stunned. And they were pounding on the table and speaking with such passion, such ferocious passion. And then everyone started singing again, and they actually grabbed hands and started dancing. And I thought, oh my God, I get it now. Like, that's why this is feels so real to me, because it's actually about something. And the things that I believe are most, you know, are impacting our world are actually part and parcel of the religious experience in this place. And it was a moment of an absolutely revelatory moment for me. Hmm. And I started going back every single week. And this, you know, this was really a formative experience
now,
for me.
Now, B'nai Jeshurun is quite a famous congregation these days, right? And they had this tremendous growth and are part of what many people are calling a Jewish spiritual renaissance. And so I think when they had moved into that church, they'd outgrown their other space, right? So they were...
Well, the synagogue roof actually fell in one morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then so they were offered to use space in a church a couple of blocks away. Mm-hmm. And by the time the synagogue was repaired, the community had doubled or tripled in size. And so they couldn't even move back into theirs.
And,
I mean, so now they use
the
synagogue occasionally. They have simultaneous, they have concurrent services happening. So. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of it because I really wasn't part of the Jewish conversation at all. And so for me, it was so startling, and it is so absolutely revolutionary. I mean, it's completely different from the experience in any other place. And so, I mean, I'd been to dozens and dozens of synagogues and never experienced anything like this. So this kind of awakened me to what's actually possible in the religious life and what's possible in a spiritual community,
right.
Now I believe, you know, as I sort of try to craft a High Holy Day experience for my own community, I believe that this is absolutely our obligation to strive for this in every experience that we create for the community. But I understand, and I actually say to people all the time, you know, if services feel the way my services felt growing up, I hope you'll go to a movie instead of coming here, because I mean, just the because there are better things for us to be doing with our time than to be sort of forcing ourselves to sit through something that's just treacherous. And
right.
So what I want to do is kind of awaken the spirit to what's possible, both, you know, for us as individual human beings and also, you know, for us as a Jewish community and for the whole world. What do we want the world to look like, and what are we doing about it? And if that kind of conversation is not being provoked by the experience of being in services, so then I don't know what we're actually doing there, because it doesn't serve anyone's purpose to just be sitting through something for 2 hours and then leave.
Right. So I mean, here's some of the language that that you'll find in kind of classic or formal introductions about the High Holy Days. You know, that this is a time of solemn rejoicing, that it is evokes a fear of judgment coupled with confidence of atonement. And I think, you know, those words themselves, which are so central to the High Holy Days, don't evoke what you're describing about what you value in worship in modern years. Do you know what I mean? And maybe it's what
right.
we've done with words like that, or with the ideas behind them. I mean, so right. Yeah, how do you think about that?
A couple of things. Yeah. I mean, one, for as alienated as people are by the Hebrew in the prayer book, in either the Siddur or the Machzor, the prayer book that we use for High Holy Days, often the English is far worse than the Hebrew, because mm-hmm. using words like that that don't resonate for many of us, it just makes it feel even more alien. And so at least the Hebrew, you know that you don't know it, and so there's some kind of air of mystery
okay.
to it.
Yeah.
But language like that, I'll share with you an experience that we had our first year at High Holy Days. We started our community just 3 months before High Holy Days. And so the
How long ago was that?
That was 2004. It's been 3 years
okay.
now.
All right.
So our first year at High Holy Days, I felt that everyone walked into Yom Kippur expecting this, like as if they're supposed to be sad, as if it's kind of almost a day of mourning,
yeah.
And real suffering and anguish. And that's not the way I understand what High Holy Days are about. I said, this is a moment in which we celebrate the possibility of transformation, the possibility that every single one of us can be recreated, that we can allow ourselves to become everything that we want to be in the world, in which we identify that we have a real purpose and meaning in the world, and that we can redirect our lives so that we're actually responsively going after those priorities instead of, you know, following whatever the issue of, you know, whatever the needs of the day are, instead of being bogged down by our carpooling schedules. You know, we actually have the capacity to radically transform the way that we understand our lives and the world. So really, this is a moment of celebration. And after I said this, I kind of, preached this spontaneous thing about celebration. So people just stood up and started dancing in the room. And I thought, oh, this is really so beautiful. I mean, we'd had a few Shabbos services before and people had danced a little bit. But the whole room got up. There were, 400 people there the first year.
Yeah.
And they started dancing and dancing. And we were singing.
So there was music. And then, there was...
Well, yeah, but we don't use musical instruments in our community. So so this is part of the thing. I couldn't control it because it was just my voice. And so I thought, well, I'll let them, dance. They clearly need to dance. We'll dance for 3 or 4 minutes, but still it's Yom Kippur. So
right.
we have to,
So this was on Yom Kippur that you said this.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. This is on Kol Nidre. It's the, evening
Kol
of Yom, the beginning of Yom Kippur.
Right.
It is a serious time.
Very serious.
But I was preaching celebration.
Yeah.
So people started celebrating the possibility of transformation. And I was trying after a couple of minutes with my voice to kind of end the singing and dancing so that it could come back to the seriousness of Yom Kippur. But people kept dancing, and I realized it was out of my hands. For 45 minutes, people danced around that room, and it was this ecstatic, extraordinarily exquisite moment where I just realized that, I mean, this is where people's hearts were. Like something had been opened up in them and kind of released the possibility of not only transforming the self, but transforming their whole perception of what Judaism was, what synagogue was supposed to feel like. And it was incredible. And I was so grateful that I didn't have the power to shut it off, afterwards in retrospect.
You know, and I'm thinking of Kol Nidre is associated with melody and with, this very beautiful renditions of that. I mean, by Max Bruch, I'm thinking, but they're quite formal. I mean, I don't see people dancing to that.
Well, this was at the end of the service.
Oh, okay.
So. Yeah. No, and I mean, I think part of this is, I think part of the challenge of High Holy Days is to mm-hmm. To allow people to really, for a moment, and at some point during the hours and hours and hours that we spend really trying to focus our hearts and our minds over High Holy Days, to bring people to one momentary understanding of the fragility of life, of the recognition that they might not be here next year at this time, and I might not be here next year at this time, and the people they love most in the world might not be here, because we can't control human existence. We have no idea who will live and who will die in a very real sense, not just who's going to have a year full of joy and who's going to feel very, who's going to have a year of struggle.
Right.
But really, we don't know who will live and who will die. And to kind of push people to confront that excruciating reality for just a moment, and then to dance their way out of that, to sort of hold in their hands at one moment the utter seriousness and really the pain of that, for all people who love, to think about the people they love most and knowing that they or the people they love might not be here next year is excruciating. But to take that and to leave with a commitment to live a life in which in a life in which they're able to transform themselves and their relationships and the world, knowing that every day they have might be their last. But to really leave with a sense of commitment and a sense of purpose, that's something to dance about, I think. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of living in both of those places at once, both recognizing the tragedies that have struck, you know, us as individuals, as communities, you know, in as a nation, as a world, to sort of be very present to the reality of loss and grief and death, and then to leave to sort of holding that, to be able to dance and to be able to affirm the possibility of love and renewed life and renewed sense of purpose. That's, I think, what the great challenge is of High Holy Days.
And I mean, it is deeply countercultural because our culture beats back that knowledge and that awareness, right? Or would think about dancing your way out of it, or right, dancing as a way to live despite it. But I mean, you're talking about celebrating because of it. I mean, it's celebrating life in a different way because you've fully faced those realities of life.
That's right. And I think there are multiple responses to kind of being confronted with the reality of one's mortality, mm-hmm. and also of the mortality of the people we love. I think, you know, many people live in denial. That denial is a real response to mortality.
Yeah.
I think paralysis is a response, you know, kind of just not being able to get out of bed because of the terror of what has happened or what could happen. I think hedonism is a response. And I'll always remember, I was living in New York City when September 11th happened. And the sounds that I heard, there was a little bar called The Underground right at the corner of my block on the Upper West Side. And the sounds that I heard coming out of the bar that night on September 11th, 2001, it was mind-blowing. It was like screaming, like joy and laughter and dancing. Mm. And it was almost this kind of like ultimate rejection of the reality of what had happened. I mean, we smelled the smoke in our apartment, mm-hmm. and there were ashes on our windowsill, and people were like literally like, you know, just in drunken revelry, which is, I think,
drowning,
you know,
that out.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And I think that, you know, I think that is also one response. And our tradition says, don't ignore the reality, because these, you know, these kind of paths of response to mortality are so, all of them are so debilitating. So it says, don't ignore the reality, and the tradition doesn't say don't be afraid. It says be afraid, but do something with your fear. Right. Do something productive in the world with your fear. And there's this incredible prayer that we say on High Holy Days called Unatana Tokef, which is, you know, this famous prayer written by Reb Amnon of Mainz, where he says, you know, who will live and who will die, who by fire, who by water. It sort of goes through all of the possible ways that we might achieve our demise over the course of the year. And many commentators try to read into this prayer some kind of beautiful poetic understanding of how to live a life that will be really full of life, who will really be alive this year, and who will kind of live a spiritual death this year. But I take this prayer very literally. I mean, and I think Rev Amnon of Mainz, who said this only days before his death, he was a young rabbi who was beaten and tortured brutally and died almost immediately after reciting this prayer spontaneously. I think he was saying, I had no idea that it would be me, and now it's me. And every one of you needs to focus on, you know, take the opportunity to realize it could be you next. And so what do you do with it? And he says that there are three things. He says, tshuva, tefila, utzdaka. So tshuva, the watchword of the whole High Holy Day season, the possibility of utter transformation of self, that we can
translate as repentance. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Repentance, which again is one of those dry English words.
Yeah.
Right. Like, what does that mean? I mean, and by the way, there's some words that, you know, just they feel meaningless to us just because they're not words that we use often. There are other words that feel to many Jews, they feel like Christian words.
Right.
And so we don't really understand, you know, we don't really resonate to
them. Yeah. That's true. It's a Christian word, but I'm thinking also, I'm thinking of a little bit I learned about Hebrew that just isn't that word in Hebrew quite visual, like stopping in your tracks and turning around the other direction or something?
That's
like that.
Exactly what it is.
Right.
It's return. It's literally returning to a right path. And I mean, the whole Jewish notion of sin is you've just gone astray, and you can turn it around. And, you know, the principle, the fundamental principles of tshuva, of return is that human beings have free will. We have the capacity to make great mistakes, and we have the capacity to turn it around. And there are very clear prescriptions laid out for how you turn it around. What do you actually need to do to repair something when there's been a breach in a relationship, in your relationship with God, in your relationship with your mother, in your relationship with, you know, with your partner? How do you make repair? How do you actually turn it around? And of course, there's certain things that there is no full tshuva that can be affected for, because the damage is irreparable. Things like murder and sexual assault and some kinds of public humiliation, mm-hmm. that it's impossible to ever fully turn back. But nevertheless, I mean, there are still certain things that you can do, but you can't affect full tshuva. But for everything else, our tradition says it's possible to turn your life around, to mm-hmm. really transform the way that you're living, and to make amends in a way that will heal the breach that you've caused in the relationship, either, you know, with yourself, with God, with someone in the community, with the world. Mm. And that's really, I think, also the ultimate challenge of Rosh Hashanah, which is, we call it, you know, in the prayers we say Hayom Harat Olam. Today is the birthday of the world, and Rosh Hashanah is this. It's this moment in which we celebrate the creation of the world, which meant nothing to me, you know, when I heard that
right.
growing up. Today we celebrate the creation of the world. That means nothing.
Right.
But what does mean something to me is the fact that each one of us participates in creation every single day when we make a choice about how we want to live in the world. And we have the capacity and the opportunity to recreate ourselves on a daily basis, you know, based on the choices that we make about our lives and how we want to live. And then, there are ways in the liturgy and in the religious practice, in Jewish religious practice, in which every single day we strive to kind of identify the things that need to be transformed in our lives. But the tradition also gets that that it's not enough that doing it every day it might lose some of its power. And so we need to have this, you know, this moment in time that's part of the calendrical cycle, that's, you know, sort of built into the calendar.
These kind of dramatic high holy days.
Exactly. In which we stop
stops. Everything. Right.
And I mean, even, you know, even many, you know, secular Jews or people who don't identify at all will still stop and kind of recognize it's Rosh Hashanah or it's Yom Kippur. And we have this shofar, which blasts in our ears. And it's not supposed to be beautiful and melodious. It's supposed to really wake you up and say, this is the moment for you to wake up and recreate yourself. You have the capacity to be whatever you want to be in the world. Look at yourself. Are you the mother you want to be? Are you the friend you want to be? Are you the American you want to be? Are you the human being that you want to be in the world? And if you're not, you can't blame that on anyone else, because right now you have the capacity, you have the opportunity to utterly transform your life.
Hmm. Oh, this is great.
Am I speaking too fast?
No, you and I are a lot alike. You're allowed to speak fast.
Okay.
I want to get into that a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about how this then manifests itself in worship. You know, what happens in these days that are set aside where everything stops? And I just want to mention a few pieces that really strike me. And then I also want you to throw in, you know, something that you're really passionate about.
Okay.
That you would want to talk, you want to tell somebody who's listening who knows nothing about Judaism or Jews who are listening, who, you know, you just want to share. This really matters to you. So I'm very struck by Kol Nidre, which sort of kicks it all off, with this idea. Well, you called this in your one of your sermons that you preached last year, an accounting of the soul of the Jewish people. And there's this amazing ritual that takes place, which is a declaration of permission to pray with transgressors. That's an incredible idea. Very exacting. And again, deeply countercultural. I mean, say what that means. What's happening there? And why does it start there?
Yeah, it's... My sense is that a lot of what's happening in the liturgy, and this incredibly rich and complex liturgy of High Holy Days, is that the rabbis are trying to very cautiously push us to confront the parts of ourselves that we are simply not open to confronting when we walk in the door. And so it's in some ways it's very subtle what they're trying to do. But listing, there's the vidui, the confessional, which is always said in the plural, ashamnu, bagadnu. We did this, we did this.
And you go through, is it right? You go through every single letter of the alphabet.
Yes, right? Yes, that's right. And over and over and over. We do the vidui multiple times over the course of the, you know, over the course of the day of Yom Kippur. And the idea is, I didn't do that. You know, you sort of walk in and someone gives you a list of sins that you're supposed to publicly state that you committed.
Right.
And our kind of, as you said, this is intensely countercultural because all of our impulse and all of the norms of society push us to deny and reject responsibility for the things that we're doing wrong.
You know, or I think to, you know, to get over it, to move on once, right, and not relive mm-hmm. it every year. Mm-hmm. Right. Go on.
And this says, we did these things. Each one of us did these things. And even if you personally didn't do it, someone in this community did it.
So give me an example. So what are you saying, for example, ethical lapses, sins? I mean, what would they be?
I immediately go to, you know, to think about sort of the broad social and political ethical lapses that we have. I mm-hmm. mean, the fact that we... in Los Angeles, live in a city with 86,000 people sleeping on the streets. And so does that mean that I personally am responsible for making, you know, people creating homelessness? Mm-hmm. Or does that mean that I am responsible because I live in a society that allows certain people to remain in positions of privilege and power and to turn a blind eye to people who have tremendous suffering in their life? And so how can we start to take ownership and responsibility of some of the terrible problems that are happening in our society and in our world? So, I mean,
that you would confess at Yom Kippur.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And in the beginning, when you walk in the door, you're not necessarily ready to take responsibility for that. I mean, for the fact that there are, you know, 40 million people living with, with HIV in the world, HIV AIDS. So, you know, how do I take that burden on myself? I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, the way that I hurt my sister's feelings, the way that I was embarrassed by my mother in the supermarket because, you know, even though I'm in my 30s, she can still embarrass me in the supermarket. You know, I'm sort of thinking about those things. And I think that there's this development, there's this flow to the service in which you start by in the beginning of Rosh Hashanah, you start by acknowledging and taking responsibility for the little things that have happened in your life, the little ways in which you've made mistakes. And by the end of Yom Kippur, your soul is on fire because you start to recognize that it's all connected. And it's not just, you know, the conversation that I should have had with my best friend that I didn't have that led her astray. It's also about, you know, this genocide in Darfur, and it's about poverty and hunger and homelessness, and it's all connected. It's all like you kind of awaken yourself or open yourself up to this much broader sense of responsibility, which I think we protect ourselves from during most of the year because we simply can't hold all of that at once without being paralyzed.
Right. There is this paralysis. I mean, I think about this a lot. I think about how people in my profession, journalists, me, my fellow journalists and I, how we present people with these images of suffering, right, and violence and things that go wrong that therefore become headlines. And I think it's overwhelming for people, and it's very hard for people to make that connection when they are often just struggling to hold their lives together, right? Or to be a good mm-hmm. parent, which feels right. like a daily challenge. And or to be a good spouse, or just to be a good force in their community or their neighborhood, right? Or their city. It's right. very hard to connect the dots between my life and that world of pain and suffering out there. And I think often just because of the ways it comes to us, the forms in which it comes to us, it's just debilitating. So mm-hmm. so I guess what I want to ask you is there something that happens when those connections are made in that liturgy, in that context of religious community, of Jewish community? Is there mm-hmm. some way in which people are able to live with that differently, to hold those tensions, to walk out of there, you know, and have an idea about how to live differently because they've made them?
I hope so. And I think that that's really our job. And the way that we do that is taking people on a journey. You know, I don't start off by when people come in on Erev Rosh Hashanah, you know, the first night of Rosh Hashanah, I don't start off by saying, you know, what, look at you, what are you doing about the mess of the world? You know, we start off by saying, you know, and I, because I see this journey that sort of takes us from, as I call it, you know, as I understand it, it's really a journey from Cheshbon HaNefesh, which is an accounting of the soul of the individual, mm-hmm. to Cheshbon Nefesh HaMishpacha, to sort of looking at the way that we are in our families, accounting of the soul of our families, Cheshbon HaNefesh HaAm. This is by the time we get to Yom Kippur, an accounting of the soul of the Jewish people, and ultimately Cheshbon Nefesh HaOlam, an accounting of the soul of the whole world. And when you first start off this journey, you're not ready to think about, you know, poverty and disease and the, you know, sort of excruciating realities of the world. You first need to focus on what's going on in your own home, mm-hmm. what's going on in your own heart. What are the ways in which your insecurities have paralyzed you this year? What are the ways in which your arrogance has alienated people from you this year? What are the ways in which you haven't been the person that you need to be in the world? And, you know, our rabbis acknowledge that the way to transformation of the world starts with the self. It's through the self. And so we have to not only not disregard, but be truly attentive and sincerely attentive to really accounting for what's happening in our own personal lives first and foremost. And so we do that. We look with really, we scrutinize what's going on in our own lives. By the way, sometimes it's hard to get there because people have so many barriers up. They don't want to look at their own lives, and it's much easier for them to think about
Darfur than it is to look at poverty in Africa. Yes,
exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, I often think about those matryoshka dolls, those little Russian
yes.
wooden dolls.
Yes.
And you know, I remember my grandparents used to have these in their homes when I was a kid. I was sort of obsessed with playing with these little dolls, and you'd sort of peel away layer after layer after layer, and you'd finally come to this tiny little doll in the middle, which like almost didn't even resemble the biggest doll on mm-hmm. the outside anymore, because it was just this tiny pure essence of doll in the middle of all of these layers and layers of you know, beautiful paint and gloss. And I feel like that's what the experience of High Holy Days is about, to, you know, sort of begin by saying there is a nikuda tova, there is something so pure and so good inside of you, inside of all of us, but we can't even see what it is anymore because we spend all year kind of papering over it and covering over it, either because we're too busy, because, you know, our lives and our work are too challenging, you know, or because we're too embarrassed of it. And we don't, you know, we're sort of ashamed or embarrassed. And so we cover over and we paper over and layer over it. And you kind of walk in on Erev Rosh Hashanah and you hear these melodies that just kind of stir the soul of even a person who's, you know, maybe only been to services, you know, in their early childhood and only out
right.
of guilt, you know.
Right.
But you hear these tunes that are only sung on High Holy Days, and like layer by layer, you're sort of stripped down to the core, if it works. You know, this is what we're trying
yeah.
to do.
So in your congregation, sort of, the melodies would be sung. They would be human voices, rather. You said you don't have
yes.
instruments, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's uh-huh. right. And everybody sings. I mean, we just kind of open it up, like just. Mm-hmm. And I say, like, the goal of this evening and tomorrow morning and the next day of Rosh Hashanah is to peel those layers down so that we get back to that holy, pure light inside of every human being. And we can start to figure out, you know, who we are and who we want to be again, so that when we start to build out, you know, the coming year, we know that we're starting off in a direction that we want to go in. It's kind of the denial of the snowball effect. Like, you can't say, you know, kids who cheat once on a test in seventh grade become the cheaters. And it's like, that's just what happened. Like, they're the kid who cheated. So then they start cheating in eighth grade and ninth grade. And, you know, they're sort of stuck in this, it's like this self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is saying, you know, there is no snowball effect in Judaism. You
right.
can't say, like, I met, you
You're
know,
saying
I
the snowball can stop in its tracks and roll back
exactly.
up the hill.
Exactly. Okay. Stop it now.
Okay.
And like, and figure out that it's like exactly what you were describing about your understanding of tshuva. Like, just turn it around and go back up the hill and take away those layers that you don't want, like unpeel those layers and actually become, you know, what you want to be again. And there's this beautiful teaching from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov who talks about the nikuda tova, kind of finding that pure essence of a person, finding that point of light. And then he says that this light can then illuminate the entire body. And, you know, most of the time, you know, we could have a body that's kind of covered in darkness, but still has that tiny pure light. And on High Holy Days, I believe we get, like, we sort of take away and peel off all the darkness. So it's just the light again. And then the light can leave its impression on the rest of the body. So we have this kind of opportunity to start with a clean slate. And I think that the way that this works, you know, liturgically also is... the stories of that we read from the Torah on Rosh Hashanah are so interesting.
I want to talk. Great, that's great. That's where I want to go now.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's. I mean, they are so interesting, and they're also. I mean, they're amazing stories about what it means to be Jewish and what it means to be human, right? But they're all also a little bit confusing. I think there are stories that a modern person couldn't just pick up the Bible and read and know. And really say, well, you know, what does that mean? Or isn't that very paradoxical? Or doesn't it, you know, what is the point here? So,
right.
So talk about that. The first day you read about the birth of Isaac, right?
Yeah, you read this. What I find somewhat astounding is how it's not obvious what the rabbis were trying to do here, but it's brilliant that they chose these readings for these moments.
Okay, so tell me about
that. It's the first day of Rosh Hashanah. You know, Jews who never go to synagogue all year long will show up on, you know, Rosh Hashanah morning. And, you know, this is it's a Torah portion. The Torah portion that it comes from has, you know, arguably two of the most famous and most profound episodes of the entire Torah. They have Abraham arguing with God over the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and where you see this real, like, this fierce human defiance and this sense of, you know, there's no moral ambiguity here. It's just human beings fighting for what's right in the world. And then, on the other side of the Torah portion, there is this, there's the Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, you know, God saying to Abraham, take your son and sacrifice him. So what do we read on Rosh Hashanah? Neither of those things. We come and we read these little stories that come in the middle, in between those two things, which is, it's so fascinating. It's like you have all the Jews you want in the world sitting in services and you're not telling them, you know, the great major moral lessons of the Torah, but you're telling them instead, you know, about Sarah being jealous of Hagar.
Yes.
Because the way that, that Isaac and Ishmael fought with each other and Abraham sort of struggling, should he listen to Sarah or Hagar and needing to kick his own, you know, family out of the house. It's kind of these very small stories of dysfunction in our ancestors, families. And so, yes. And I think it's,
go on. Well, just, yes, perhaps small stories of dysfunction, but a family feud that is arguably at the center of some of the hardest things that are happening in the world today, right? Because Ishmael, it becomes an ancestor of Muslims, and that is a very puzzling story. Hagar is this Egyptian slave woman who Abraham has had this son with, and Sarah banishes him, and yet God does preserve Ishmael from death and say that he will bless him. And I mean, this is also a puzzling story, I think, in the Torah. And how do you think about what that story says to Jews today in 2007?
So, I understand it in a couple of different ways. Mm-hmm. And I mean, on one level, it's really saying, you know, our God is not the God of the Jews. Our God is God. Mm. And, you know, Abraham was not the father of the Jewish people. Abraham was, you know, was the father of Ishmael and Isaac. He didn't have only one son. He had two sons. And, you know, ultimately, like, taking us back to, you know, to sort of the creation of our faith, the origin story of our faith, where we realize that we are in this story with other human beings in the world. So our obligations in the world simply cannot extend only to other Jews, which I think, by the way, is a theme that's carried through through the reading of the book of Jonah in Yom Kippur, where it's so powerfully expressed. And this is, you know, so this is the beginning of the High Holy Days, and 10 days, you know, saying there are other people in the world aside from Isaac. And actually, when Ishmael was kicked out of the family, it was incredibly painful, even for Abraham himself. You know, there are other human beings in the world. But then on Yom Kippur, when we read the book of Jonah, we hear the voice of God saying to this Jewish prophet, I don't just care about you. Go to Nineveh and tell these people that if they don't stop sinning, I'm going to destroy their country. And Jonah, who just doesn't get it, because he says, but I'm a Jew. I care about the Jews.
And he doesn't think they should be saved, right?
That's mm-hmm. right. I mean, well, first of all, he doesn't believe that it's his job to engage them.
Okay.
He says, I don't care if you save them or don't, but that's not my job. Like, I'm a Jewish prophet. Leave me alone. I'm with my folks. And literally gets in a boat and tries to flee to go anywhere but to Nineveh because he doesn't want to engage in other people's problems. And God just tracks him down and says, no, this is what it means to be a Jew. It means to go out and do the work of the world and really, inspire transformation wherever you can in the Jewish community or far beyond the Jewish community. And you need to care about these human beings because they're all my children. And Jonah, this reluctant prophet then goes and prophesies the destruction of Nineveh. And the people of Nineveh are, they're smarter than Jonah is because he says, you're going to be destroyed. And they say, what if we transform ourselves? Then how could God destroy us if we have transformed ourselves? And once they do affect, they make tshuva, this return.
Right.
And once they do it, God refuses to destroy them. And then Jonah's angry at God because then Jonah says, you didn't keep your word. You made me look like a fool. It's like a shanda for the goyim. You made me look stupid in front of the non-Jews. That's even worse than looking stupid in front of the Jews. And so Jonah just doesn't get it. So this is an interesting end to it. It's kind of in some ways a mirror to the Abraham story of Rosh Hashanah. I see this all on some kind of continuum. Like in the beginning, in the book, in Rosh Hashanah, we're kind of opening up to the possibility of universalism, and by the end of Yom Kippur, we're screaming universalism. It's like, no, don't go thinking that your job in the world is just to fix yourself, or just to fix your family, or just to fix the Jews. Your job is to go out and transform the world. So this is one rendering of what these Torah stories, these particular Torah stories are doing on Rosh Hashanah. And the other piece of it that I also think is very powerful, which is not about the universalism, is actually, I think about honoring and recognizing that these small stories and the jealousies that one woman feels toward another and the confusion that one man feels about his, his partner and his love and the jealousy and the conflict between two siblings, these stories of dysfunction are our stories.
Right.
That, every single one of us has some kind of conflict in our families and in our homes that has shaped who we are in the world for better and for worse. And so in a way, we're honoring those stories. We're saying, to be a Jew doesn't just mean to engage in the great, mysteries of the world. And it doesn't just mean to go out with this profound, mission to bring justice to the world. It actually means to look at what's happening in your family and to recognize what's unfair as unfair and to recognize the gifts as utter gifts. I mean, the fact that love is possible in times of great confusion and darkness, the fact that, that human commitments to one another can help us overcome even the deepest darkness, that's something to really honor and to recognize. So I look at Rosh Hashanah morning, I look at these stories as an opportunity for us to really hear the absence of the big stories really focus on the small stories in between. It's not just your father died this year. There was this incredibly painful thing that transformed your family, or you got married this year and there's this incredibly beautiful celebration. But what happened in between those things? How are you treating your partner on the day when there aren't any camera crews and families that have flown in to celebrate with you? How do you look at each other when you wake up in the morning? How do you talk to your kids when you're frustrated because you've called them down for dinner 7 times and they're not coming? How do we engage each other in the small stories? And I think that's incredibly important in this moment of Hayom Harat Olam. Today is the birthday of the world. We have this big mission in the world. There's something for us to do as Jews. How are you treating your family? Are you talking to the people you love?
I have to say that while I'm listening to you talk both about that, about, how we think about family these days and how we're able to talk about it, and also about these large themes of being Jewish and also this, being Jewish maybe meaning that you have to be in relationship with those others. I think about the richness of Jewish tradition, and I just, the whole historic tradition, and of Talmud, of conversation across generations, of Midrash, mm-hmm. and kind of making the story your own in every new generation. And mm-hmm. I mean, I really hear you doing that, because I think the way you're reading that story of the relationship between Isaac and Ishmael is going to be different in the 21st century than a rabbi would have been reading it 50 years ago, or let's say 60 years ago, in the middle of a world of, you know, of the Holocaust and World War II. I mean, it does speak to our dynamics in a completely new way, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, that's what I think the rabbis meant when they said that the Torah was given down in fire, meaning on Mount Sinai, the mountain was on fire when the Torah came down. And in Torah, it has to be transmitted. And if we don't find some way to make this religious experience about more than just the memory of something that once touched our great-great-grandparents, it's simply not going to exist anymore. And so, I mean, so what does it mean to me? And by the way, not only does it mean something different to me than it meant to my grandparents, it means something different to me this year than it meant to me last year.
Right, right.
And that's sort of the, you know, the great power of a religious tradition that's versatile enough to really sustain itself over the course of many thousands of years, to say, you know, the text is the same every year, but we are different. Mm. And so how do we approach this text with our own eyes? And what sustenance can we derive from this text and this liturgy and this story? Because this is our story. And the way that I experience it right now, that really is, there is something new born every time that I encounter this text or this holiday or this piece of, you know, this piece of liturgy.
You know, you wrote somewhere how you luxuriated in rabbinical school and the magic, inspiration, and fierce challenge of Talmud and traditional text study. And I'm just, you know, what you're talking about is, as a rabbi, how you take that intense study and then translate it for people who haven't had that luxury of theological education, of rabbinical school. And I mean, I'm just, you know, something that's one of the ideas behind at Rosh Hashanah is that two books are open before the heavenly judge, the book of life and the book of death. I mean, those are such huge and strange images. And so, you know, I'm just throwing that out. And so, I mean, do you think images like that can come to life for, or how do images like that come to life for modern people in Los Angeles?
Right. Look, not everything works. I mean, not everything resonates. And so, and I think this is part of the beauty of really engaging in a tradition seriously and with an open heart. It's just like how in your own family, everything doesn't always work.
Right.
But sort of recognizing that this is mine, and what works for me now might not work for me next year. And what works for me next year might not work for me now. And I mean, I've had people in my community who have been diagnosed with cancer who say, I now get for the first time what it means to pray to a warrior God, because I want God to be fighting the cancer in my body. Huh. And I never would have thought about God that way before, because I'm a pacifist, you know? And so, I mean, and there are things that happen in our lives and in the world that open us up to the possibility of, you know, different interpretations of things. And so I don't take things out of the book. I struggle with things, and there are things that I scream out against. I mean, I see them and I think, oh, this doesn't speak to me, or this just seems wrong, but it's still in the book, because next year I might get it in a different way. And I think that's kind of, it's sort of some kind of religious humility in a way, to say, like, it doesn't work for me at all, and yet I'm going to continue to struggle with it, or I'm at least going to continue to keep it on the page. And I had this experience, you know, in rabbinical school about every 6 months, and I was really in a love affair with the study of Talmud and rabbinic texts. And I mean, about every 6 months, I would come across some text that I found utterly paralyzing as a woman, as a human being, as a Jew. I just felt like this is the text I'm in love with, and this is what it's saying. How can I, you know, how can I deal with that? And I came to recognize those moments as incredible gifts also. Because the relationship with Judaism should be no different than your relationship with your, you know, with your partner, your spouse,
or your
kid.
You find things about them that you don't like and you have to live with, nevertheless.
That's exactly right.
Can you give me an example? Can you remember an example?
Yeah, sure. Again,
okay.
There's a story in Masechet Nedarim, in this tractate of Talmud, that talks. It's talking about sexual relationships, and it says that that a husband and wife are allowed to do basically they're allowed to do whatever they want with each other sexually, which I think people found very liberating back then because it was this kind of response to, you know, the eyes of the rabbis in the bedroom saying, you know, you can't do whatever you want behind closed doors. Okay. Well, the rabbis came out and said you can. I mean, it's yours. You know, this is your spouse, and you can enjoy each other. That's okay. That's not heretical, and we're not an ascetic tradition, and that's permissible. So then there's a story in which a woman comes before Rav, one of the great rabbis, and says, "My husband did this thing to me, and it's caused me incredible pain." And Rav says, "What can I do? The Torah permits you to him." And like sort of throws his hands up in the air. And so, you know, I read things like that and I think, like, where is the understanding of human relationships here? Like, where's the understanding of how men and women operate and how law interacts with humanity? And, you know, I sort of read things like that, even in the book of Deuteronomy. I mean, this is not a rabbinic text, but a biblical text. But, you know, the punishment for raping a woman is marrying her. That your your punishment is that you need to spend eternity. You marry her, and you're not allowed to divorce her. Hmm. And you know, you read things like that, and I read things like that, and I think, my God, you know, this tradition is so painful in some ways. And if I were writing the book, I would not have written that. I'm quite sure of it, you know. But I didn't write the book, and I'm sure if I was writing this book, I wouldn't have had the, you know, I wouldn't have been able to say. I wouldn't have been able to say, "Lo ta'amod al dam re'acha." You are not allowed to stand on your brother's blood when someone around you is in pain. You cannot stand there and do nothing. You have an affirmative obligation to act. I mean, the wisdom that flows from this text comes from the same source as the excruciating pain that flows from it. And I feel now that that's part of being in a relationship with a, you know, with a tradition that's thousands of years old. And what's so powerful to me about this is because I've cried so many tears over texts like this. I feel like my tears are now part of the mix of the, you know, of the conversation of Jews who for the past 2,000 years have used these texts as their, really as their sustenance. You know, there's an amazing story that that one of my teachers, Rabbi David Weiss Halivni, teaches and shares in one of his books. He was he's a Holocaust survivor, and he was in one of the death camps, and he was working, and they came back from this day out laboring all day long, you know, on the verge of death, and from exhaustion and from hard labor. And from despair, and he saw this security guard who was eating this sloppy sandwich in a wrapper, and it was wrapped in this piece of paper, and he couldn't take his eyes off it because he recognized that there were Hebrew letters written on the paper. And so he found out that all the prisoners kind of gathered around, and they traded their their food for the day in order to get this piece of sloppy paper that was holding together this sandwich. And he gave it to them, and they dried it out, and it turned out to be a piece of Talmud. And I guess one of the ways that you know, the Jews were degraded was they would take our holy texts and use them in really degrade, you know, like as you know for a variety of reasons. And so they took this piece of Talmud, and he describes how the men in the bunker used to sit together every night when they'd come home from the field and just read this piece of Talmud together, and it saved their lives. Like, just looking at this text made them feel like human beings again, and made them feel like they were part of a story that was, you know, thousands of years long and wouldn't die with them. It would continue somehow beyond them. And I think about that often, and I think about the voices that have been a part of that story, and the voices like mine, you know, women's voices that weren't a part of those stories. And how do we start to fill in, you know, the conversation that's in the white parts of the page, in between the black letters, you know, the white space in between the letters.
And part of it is the spirit of Midrash, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. And so, I mean, literally, like, I love when I'm studying and I cry and I see a teardrop fall into my book. I feel like that's the holiest act, because I'm leaving my imprint here too, because men could have read that for thousands of years and not cried. When I read that, I cry. I really do. So, and now I feel like that's part of being in love, that, you know, sort of really struggling in that way and knowing that something's wrong, and that my partner, this tradition, has made mistakes, and, you know, God knows, so have I. And it's in some ways, you know, it's good to know that the tradition's not perfect.
You've written about one of the things that is affected by the High Holy Days as a renegotiated marriage, right? between God and humankind, and the people right. who are observing these holy days. I wonder, talk to me about what kind of God and what kind of relationship between humankind and God is made real in you through these liturgies and through these religious ideas behind them. And maybe you can only answer that question for this year, because next year it will be different.
I think this idea of, I'm very struck by the idea of a renegotiated marriage, which I think I heard for the first time from Rabbi Art Green, just this idea that we get to set the marriage back on course. We're periodically given this opportunity to realign and to set straight our priorities again, and to redefine what kind of relationship we even want to be in.
With God.
I believe with God. Mm-hmm. And I believe that we need to fix ourselves, and God needs to fix God's self also. And there are some incredibly beautiful prayers, a very famous one from Rav Levi Yitzchak, the Berditcher Rebbe, who writes this prayer where he says, you know, God, I did my work this year, but where are you? Mm-hmm. You know, how could you let the world look the way that it does? Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity for us to look in a really brutal way at ourselves and say, you know, where have I not been the human being I need to be in the world? And where have I let myself down and let other people down and let God down? And also to look at God and say, where are the ways that I feel that I've been let down by God? Because what I believe, ultimately, the breach, the covenant, is about God wanting us to make those demands also. Hmm. God wanting us to hold God to the fire and say, mm-hmm. like, wait a minute, mm-hmm. this isn't what you promised. Like, how could you let this person get sick? Or how could you let this thing happen in the world? And that's okay for us to, you know, to offer that kind of expression to God. God actually wants to be in a relationship like that hmm. with us. But we have to do it for ourselves also. I mean, that's, you know, that's the first step, is to really have the courage and the integrity to look at ourselves and say, God, I've fallen short. You know, I haven't been what I could be in the world. And here you gave me, you know, the capacity with my mind and my body and my spirit to do extraordinary things in the world. And because of my distractions and my insecurities and my self-doubt and my, you know, and my sins, you know, the things I've done that have just been wrong, I haven't been everything you've wanted in the world. To really start from that place and then grow, you know, to the place where we say, God, and you haven't either.
And you said mind, body, and spirit. And one thing I've heard about worship in your congregation is that it is full body worship. I mean, you've talked about dancing, and I think Jewish prayer is full body prayer. But I've also heard that people are fully prostrated in your synagogue. And, you know, that's something that's a very ancient practice, but it actually is a practice in many other parts of the world and in other traditions, but it's pretty much lost in Western culture, except in Orthodoxy, I suppose. And so talk to me about what that means in a very modern congregation in a modern American city. Why is that important to you? And what does it do to people? You know, how does it play into this renegotiated marriage?
There was recently a terrible tragedy in my community. There was a man who died, and I was speaking with the family, and part of the challenge for them was, in particular for the mother, was not being able to control what was happening, because she just wanted to take care of everything and make everything okay. And like, there was just this recognition that she simply couldn't, there was nothing that she could do to change what had happened, and to, you know, and to bring some closure to this any more quickly, you know, than it would come. And I thought, as I was talking to her, I thought about Aleinu, this moment that you're describing in the High Holy Day service, where, I mean, this feels so un-Jewish to people, to the idea of prostrating, like putting your whole body on the ground. Yeah. It just feels like it's, you know, from another tradition and from another time. But it's this idea of recognizing for one moment that we simply cannot control everything. And you know, for people who really spend their days trying to get control over their inbox and control over their, you know, their work life and control over their kids and control over the way their bodies, you know, look and the way that, you know, the way that everything.
Our aging.
Exactly. Like, you don't like the way you look, you get surgery. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't, like, we, we try to exert control over all aspects of our life, and there are just moments when you realize that you just can't control everything. And what happens to a person kind of spiritually when they allow themselves to acknowledge that the world is bigger than them, and that there's something greater at play than just what we're able to control with our own hands. And the act of putting ourselves down on the ground, and I, you know, when I do it, I hold my hands up to, like, my hands are facing upward. It's just saying, I can't do it all. I just can't do, like, I need you to hold me in this moment, because I can't control it. I can't do it. I don't have all the answers. There's this moment of incredible profundity that comes from the recognition that no matter how hard we try, we simply cannot control everything. And I ask everyone to do it. And I say, the more uncomfortable you are with this, the more important it is that you do it, because, you know, spiritual wakefulness does not come from doing the things that feel easy and comfortable to us. It just doesn't. It comes from really pushing ourselves. Like, we get this about physical workouts. I mean, think of physical therapy. Like, you aren't going to get better if you don't push yourself in a way that hurts. And I really believe that, you know, part of my role as a religious, as a spiritual leader is to do it, you know, that great old saying that our job is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable.
Yes.
And I feel like that's exactly right. That's what we're there to do. And those people who are in mourning and who've suffered loss and who just need to be held, I want to hold them. And those people who've created the some image or some understanding of their lives as, you know, as perfect and everything's fine, and, you know, that sort of leads to this great complacency, my job is to break them down, you know, to say, get down on the ground and put your hands up in the air and say, I cannot do it. I need help from someone or something bigger than me in the world.
And as you say, that flies in the face of so much of the logic of our culture. And, you know, when I was preparing to interview you, I was reading just a number of things. And I read a New York Times article, this is from a decade ago, about B'nai Jeshurun, the congregation, the really cutting-edge congregation that you were at in New York. And here's what a journalist said, and I think this is one way, you know, it's possible to cover religion as though you're taking it seriously and yet dismiss it at the same time. So here's this journalist said, the reasons for this sudden growth are reflective of the times when baby boomers of all denominations are turning to religion to ease the ragged passage through middle age. Mm-hmm. What you're describing, though, is not about making yourself feel better. You know,
in some ways it's about making yourself feel worse.
Right. And yet you also have a wonderful, growing, vibrant congregation. So how do you explain that?
Look, I mean, this kind of dismissive observation about B'nai Jeshurun, you know, I hear people talk about my generation, about people in their 20s and 30s all the time by saying this is the most narcissistic generation in the history of the world. Now, I believe that they probably said that about every generation, but they specifically say it about this one.
But if that's true, your congregation should be empty, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, they particularly say it because of technology, because of iPods and emails and instant messaging. We do have the capacity now. Yeah, I mean, things that, by the way, this is where I noticed the great distinction between, you know, early 30s and late 20s. Like, a lot of this stuff I missed by a couple of years.
Okay.
But, this generation does have the ability to sort of access whatever it wants, when it wants it. You know, you don't listen to the radio anymore kind of, hoping to hear your favorite song. You just download your favorite song. And as soon as you don't like it anymore, you wipe it off your iPod. And, you know, it's just different. And so, you know, there's this question, like, in this generation of kind of instant gratification and instant access and, you know, and real narcissism, how do you move people from a service of the self into a service of the world? And a lot of people just throw their hands up in the air. And really, I will tell you that what I hear over and over and over from the institutional Jewish world is, let's forget about them. They'll come back when they have kids and they need religious school. Mm. And, you know, there's this kind of like throw your hands in the air. They don't want this because they're narcissistic or they want instant gratification. And you don't get that from a serious study of Talmud. You know, it takes, you can study one paragraph for 5 weeks and you come to the word teku at the end, which means there's no answer. We don't know the answer. And like that, this generation, as you know, the common wisdom is this generation wouldn't go for that. And I say, you know, it's just, it's not true. It's simply not true that, I mean, there is a human need that I believe transcends generational differences, transcends time. There's a human need for meaning, for purposeful connection, for community, and for real engagement in the world. And so it's our choice to, you know, it's our choice to either create space for that to happen or say, you know, this generation wants something that we can't offer, and so forget about them. Hmm. So, I mean, our community, I make demands on our community. And I say, I don't even want you to join. You know, there's always this numbers game in the Jewish world. Like, how many members do you have? We want more members. And I say, don't join this community unless you seriously resonate with the vision and the values of this community, unless you believe that our spiritual and religious lives have a distinct impact on the way that we live as human beings in the world, in the pursuit of social justice. And, you know, unless you are willing to make commitments to increase your Jewish learning and the depth of your Jewish, you know, spiritual and religious life, unless you're willing to make a commitment to engage in the tikkun, in the healing of our city and of our world, unless you're willing to really explore your relationship with Israel and try and understand what that's all about, and, you know, then you can make a commitment to this community and then we'll have you as members. But if you don't, we're not trying to just get people in here. And you know what? I mean, 80% of our communities in their 20s and 30s, like the, you know, the very people who everyone says forget about them, they don't have kids yet, like the people respond to I think that people respond to, you know, a serious, meaningful, high level conversation about what our purpose and meaning is in the world.
Right. It's interesting, isn't there? It's kind of a paradox in our time. I mean, I have this experience too of having a program about religion which is pitched intellectually high and which originally, even in public radio, people said, this is too dense. This is too serious. It's an hour of conversation. You know, people don't have an attention span for that. I think both things are true. I mean, I think at the same time that there's this limitless hunger and for and supply of entertainment, mindless entertainment, there's a hunger for depth. And that's what you're talking
about.
That's
right. That's what your show does so beautifully. No, it's really amazing. Like, you never, when I come to the end of your show, I think, my God, the hour's over already. You know, you think it's like 4 minutes it's like candy. So,
well, anyway. And, you know, and I have a sense that, you know, just beyond your congregation, you are part of something larger that's happening in Judaism, in this country. It isn't right at the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned this, and it's true that there was a generation in the 60s and 70s. Buddhism was brought to this country by young Jews, right, who had gone to India and learned to meditate. And a lot of the great American Buddhist leaders are Jewish. But now there's this surge in Jewish spirituality, kind of a spiritual renaissance, and B'nai Jeshurun is part of that, and Rabbi Rachel Cowan's work, I think, is part of that, and Reboot, you're part of that, which is Jewish cultural creatives, these very interesting meetings, and Ikar, which you founded. Oh, talk to me about that. What do you see yourself as part of there? What's happening that might be interesting for other people who are listening to pay attention to?
Well, I do feel that there's a resurgence in Jewish life right now. And I think, it comes in waves. And we happen to be in this incredible moment of creative opportunity right now. I believe that it is standing at the nexus of spirituality and social justice. I think there's a particular marriage there that is that's sort of setting the Jewish world a little bit on fire right now. There are organizations like Progressive Jewish Alliance here in Los Angeles and in San Francisco, Jewish social justice organizations. And you're right to mention Rabbi Rachel Cowan, this hero of, of the Jewish world, because she said there really is no Jewish spiritual life without a depth of understanding of what social justice is and means. And the rabbis of B'nai Jeshurun. There are also many particularly young Jews who are saying institutional Jewish life is not necessarily the best way for us to for us to articulate our core commitment as Jews. And so there is there's this whole birth of new minyanim, new communities, minyanim meaning small prayer groups, communities all around the country. It's happening now, and in a way that it did in the 60s in the Chavura movement, you know, this kind of counter institutional attempt to bring Judaism back to the people and out of the institutions. And I think a lot of people now, particularly my generation, are saying, you know, it's not about the you know, the beauty of the building that you're in and the how plush the seats are in your sanctuary. It's about the soul of the, you know, of the community and the spirit and the way that the liturgy can really drive, you know, drive the community. And so there are incredible communities being born really across the country, and many of them are lay-led. There are no rabbis at all. Some of them have, you know, have rabbis at the helm. They're really driven by vision and not by financial resources, which makes it raises the question, how long will these things last for?
Right.
You know, we started our community with no money at all and, you know, no space and no chairs and no books. And we just, you know, by sheer will alone, this community kind of started. And the question is, you know, how long can something like Ikar sustain itself? How long can something like these small, you know, independent minyanim sustain themselves? And I was a part of a very interesting conversation this past year. It was actually called The Conversation, and sponsored by the Jewish Week. And one of the questions was, is the tail wagging the dog in the Jewish world right now? Are these kind of small, you know, scrappy startup venture communities really making a broad impact in the institutions? And it's really interesting to think about, you know, the ways, like, I have the freedom to do whatever I want to do in my service because there's no institution. It's just my board are people who came to Ikar because they believed in, you know, in this vision, and they wanted to have a rabbi who had the freedom to do whatever she wanted to do, you know? So nothing's stopping me. So I can do whatever I want, right? So does that sort of open up the possibilities for and allow ideas to start to, you know, flourish that wouldn't necessarily be possible in the institutions, that can allow for transformation from within the big institutions as well, which I think is a very interesting question. It's definitely not only Ikar. I mean, we are part of a trend, and I do believe that there's something very interesting to explore about the intersection of social justice and spirituality and how so many of these groups of people who are really committed to, you know, to revitalizing their Jewish lives right now, get that their Jewish lives are, you know, the depth of their religious life is experienced through their encounter with the rest of the world as well. And what's interesting, I think, about this is because there's always been, you know, kind of a tikkun olam trend in Jewish life. And my life growing up in this synagogue, I mean, we didn't have any religious or spiritual life, but we knew what tikkun olam was, that, you know, sort of
the
obligation
world.
To heal the world. Yes. And I used to go down to D.C. and I'd lobby for funding, you know, for homeless shelters. And I did, like, I was a good Jew. I mean, I did, like, all those. That's what I thought that Judaism was, that, you know, that and only that. There's always been this idea that that Jews have a certain responsibility in the, you know, particularly it's flourished in the non-Orthodox world. But I think often at the expense of a real religious experience and a real Jewish experience.
Right.
And so what I really learned from my rabbis at B'nai Jeshurun, I have to say, and from rabbis like Rachel Cowan, is that you can so much more effectively fight for social change when it's really rooted in a strong and serious commitment to the tradition, you know, to the writings of our rabbis, to the prophets. When you are, you know, when you're a literate and knowledgeable Jew, you've got thousands of years of tradition standing behind you, and you don't need to make this stuff up because this really
right.
is the Ikar of our, this is the essence of our, of what our tradition says. And I mean, this is why we called the community Ikar, because it was about, in some ways, trying to strip away some of the layers that have clouded over what the Jewish mission really is in the world, and get back to the fundamentals. I mean, it is about the recognition of human dignity in the world for the Jewish people and for all human beings, and that God, that there's a God in the world who cares about human beings and wants us to be free, but will not do it for us alone, that we need to engage in the fight and the struggle for human freedom. That's the Ikar for me. And so what we wanted to do is create a space for that, you know, for that ideology and for those ideas to really flow in people's, you know, through people's bodies, and, like, you know,
right.
as they and sing and dance
that
and
is,
cry and
that
prostrate.
Is what your generation is doing, is making a connection back to the spiritual life. And it's fascinating, I think.
Thanks.
Well, look, this is really wonderful, and I have other questions I could ask you, but I think we've just got so much here. I am going to be quiet for a minute. I know that when we produce this, we're going to love to hear recommendations from you on music. And I bet you don't you don't possibly have sound from your congregation, do you, from worship
services?
You
know what? We actually just recorded our first CD. It's Shabbat, but there, I mean, some of these melodies will use the
same.
That's
great.
I can definitely get that to you.
Okay.
I can definitely get that to you. I want to just, there's one thing that we started that I didn't finish because I went on a different flow, and I wonder if we can just get back
to that.
No, do that.
Yes, please.
I was talking earlier about this, about Unetane Tokef, this incredible climactic prayer. This incredible prayer that comes in the High Holy Day services. And I was saying that, you know, this kind of pushing us to engage the reality of the possibility of our own death, who will live and who will die. And I mentioned before, so the prayer offers us three responses. You know, what do you do once you have this recognition? What do you do so that you don't turn to paralysis, hedonism, or just despair? And the tradition says, tshuva, tefila, and tzedakah. These are the three responses that we have to the fragility of life. And tshuva, you know, we talked about earlier, the possibility of transforming the way that we engage other human beings, that we can't control if we'll live or die, but we can control the way that we engage other people, and we can control the way that we engage ourselves. And then tefillah, prayer, which is we can't control if we'll live and die, but we can control the way that we engage the spirit. Right, we can decide to see ourselves, you know, alone in a world of chaos, in a world totally out of control, or we can see ourselves as part of this cosmic story, something that's bigger than us, but still depends on us, and we can learn how to sing and cry and laugh and dance in prayer this year, connecting to something holy, and the final thing is tzedakah. Justice, that we can't control if we live or die, but we can control the way that we engage the world. We can decide if we want to become completely entrenched in our own dramas, you know, the stories of our own lives, and refuse to accept that the privileges that we have in our lives as American Jews in the 20th century actually comes with real responsibility in the world. Or we can choose to open up our eyes and our hearts and really, you know, turn toward people who are just tortured by illness and poverty and violence, and really make the choice to affirm our role in the world in bringing them love and healing and comfort. And so, I mean, what this prayer basically says is realize that you cannot control if you will live or die, but you can control the way that you're going to live in, you know, over the course of the year. And that's not some vague, you know, amorphous, you know, like ambiguous statement, like feel good. But it actually means go out and do these three things. Build a spiritual life for yourself. Fix your relationships and fight for justice in the world, because ultimately those are the three things that matter in life.
I love this line from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel that I've seen you quote a couple of times. Prayer is our humble answer to the inconceivable surprise of living, and insight into the mystery of reality.
Beautiful. Yes. And so many people will come into services. So many people walk around in life so aware of what they don't have, you know, what they long for, the love that they haven't found yet, the absence. They're so aware of the absence. And what Heschel says to us is, look at the presence, like figure out what you do have. Look at the world with awe and wonder, and the amazing miracle that your skin holds the blood inside your body. You know, that nature works the way that it works, that the world is as extraordinary as it is because there's so many things wrong, but there are so many incredible blessings around us. And our part of our spiritual challenge is to, he says, it is gratefulness that makes the soul great. And so, you know, find a way to be grateful for what we do have, because it's simply not fair to live in a world and only be conscious of what you do not have.
Okay, I'm going to be quiet for just a minute while I listen in my headphones. I think we have to finish because we're going to lose our studio, but I'm going to be quiet for just a second. Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. Okay. I think we're done. But
okay.
We will be probably sending you some questions, and I know we'd love to see that CD. And also,
oh, I would love to share.
You know, maybe if there's other music or something that along the, you know, in terms of sound that you would recommend to us that could just be the layers of this. Because, you know, what we try to do in the show is not just have the conversation but evoke the experiences. So, and,
right,
you know, maybe
right.
even evoke some of the mystery. And so anyway, this is just great. I love meeting you this.
Thank you so much, Krista.
It makes me want to get on the plane and be there for your High Holy Days.
You're always welcome. We would love to have you. I'd love to be there.
Someday. Okay, thanks so,
so thank
much.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And I guess I'll just find out from your producer or something how to get the musical tracks
Yeah, Colleen will write to you and she'll give you all the info. And, we're producing this for, I think it's going to air the week before.
Great. I was going to ask
so that
about
actually
that.
People, right? Is that right, Colleen?
So they can hear.
We've got it timed so that people who are actually observing Yom Kippur can listen to it, I think.
Or Rosh Hashanah,
whatever. It will happen so that it will coincide. And I hope, you know, that it can be preparatory for people who are listening.
Oh, that's what I was hoping. I was going to ask. Because originally they said it was airing on Rosh Hashanah. So I was hoping it could be before.
Colleen said, all right, well, all right, we'll figure it out and we'll write to you. But
okay. The other thing is, our maps are, you know, they're sort of available. So I don't know.
We can let people know that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I hope
thank
I'll
you
meet
so
you
much,
sometime.
Krista. Yeah. I hope so too.
Bye bye.
Okay. Bye bye.
American Public Media.